This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the author of a new biography of Janis Joplin called Janis, Her Life and Music. Holly George Warren writes, quote, "Joplin's confident musicianship, brash sexuality, and natural exuberance locked together to produce America's first female rock star. Janis never compromised her vision. She wasn't afraid to cross boundaries, musical, cultural, and sexual. As we look back at pivotal moments in 1960s rock history, she is usually there. The Monterey Pop Festival, the vibrant Haight-Ashbury scene in San Francisco, the streets, the clubs, and studios of gritty New York City. Woodstock," unquote. Joplin's brief life was ended by a heroin overdose in 1970 when she was only 27. Her final album, Pearl, was released posthumously. Holly George Warren is also the author of The Road to Woodstock and biographies of Alex Chilton and Gene Autry. She's on the nominating committee of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and teaches at the State University of New York at New Paltz. Let's start with a track that was Joplin's commercial breakthrough with her band Big Brother and the Holding Company. This is Peace of My Heart, recorded in 1968. Holly George Warren, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks so much for having me again.
So why do you and so many others consider Janis Joplin the first woman rock star? And I presume when we say rock star, we're eliminating like rock and roll. We're eliminating like girl groups. We're talking about like rock.
Yes, Janis Joplin broke down a lot of barriers to become the woman that she was in the 1960s, when at that point in time there weren't too many women taking center stage, not only on stage in the recording studio, but even as far as a point of media attention. And Janis created this incredible image that went along with her amazing vocal ability, her talent, and also her live performance, which was very, very different than most of the women that came before.
For people who haven't seen her live or on film or video, how is her live performance different?
What made Janis really different as a live performer is that she connected with her audiences by tapping into her deepest feelings. And there was this authenticity that came across. She wasn't just standing up there singing. She was basically emptying out her guts through that amazing voice of hers and touching her audience members like they had never been touched before. I've talked to people who saw her back in 1966, 67, and they talk about it as if it was yesterday, especially women, I think, because she was able to express deep down emotions, shame, disappointments, hurts that I think a lot of women in her audience couldn't express themselves. And Janis was not only just singing to them, she was singing for them. And I think that kind of deep connection was very, very unique at that time.
She was very sexual on stage, but it wasn't in the way that you would imagine. She wasn't wearing, like, sexy clothes. She wasn't, like, revealing a lot of her body, like, on stage. So what was it about her that had so much kind of sexual energy in her performances?
You can look to two major influences that Janis had that I think affected her sexuality and the way she expressed it on stage. One was, of course, the great Bessie Smith, whose lyrics Janis knew by heart. She started out singing Bessie Smith songs way before we ever saw her, these images of her with Big Brother and the Holding Company. She started performing Bessie Smith songs in around 1963. And those kind of lyrics of sexuality, of sexual longing, sexual betrayal, those very much informed Janis's own songwriting and the songs that she chose to sing. The other major influence was Otis Redding. She was a huge Otis fan until the day she died, and she got to see him perform live three nights in a row at the Fillmore back in 1966, and it transformed her because he was a very sexual performer, and he was able to emit this heat on stage that Janis herself was able to do through her own way of manifesting these feelings that she had while singing these songs. And, I mean, Janis herself, she compared singing on stage to having an orgasm. She blew some journalists' minds when she used that expression, but it was a very sexual experience for her.
And the world of rock in the late 60s was very much a male-dominated world in the studio and in the music world. Do you think that she faced a lot of sexism when she was a performer in spite of on her way to stardom or after she reached it?
Janis was one of the boys. She considered herself one of the boys. And she kind of was outside that gender role playing at the time that was pretty much dominant in our culture. But once she was a public figure, the press would, of course, be amazed by her vocals, and critics would be talking about what a great singer she was. But they were often singling out her body parts and talking about her physical appearance in a way that, of course, you know, male singers, rock singers, were really not getting that kind of attention from the press. Also, she really had to bust down barriers to be able to have control to do what she wanted to do, because she loved being in Big Brother and the Holding Company, for example, the band with whom she catapulted to fame. But she was such a restless spirit as far as a musician goes. She wanted to keep exploring different sounds, different kinds of music. And when she did that, it was really awful in that the boys' club of music critics just kind of raked her over the coals for dropping her band and going off on her own. And they tried to say she was selling out and going showbiz. And I don't think other artists like Eric Clapton, who left plenty of bands to try different sounds, I don't think they got that kind of personal attack that Janis got.
One of Janis Joplin's most famous recordings is Ball and Chain. And that was a cover of a song that was written by and originally recorded by Big Mama Thornton. So what's the story behind how Janis Joplin first heard that song, or how someone in her band first heard that song, and how she decided to record it?
It is so poetic that Janis's breakthrough song would be written by Big Mama Thornton, Ball and Chain, because as a teenager, of course, who, like many who saw Elvis on Ed Sullivan's show, Janis loved Elvis, loved Hound Dog. But then she went to the lengths, and we don't even know how she did it, but somehow she found Big Mama Thornton's original version on a Duke Records out of nearby Houston, Texas, of Hound Dog, which was very different from Elvis's. It had a lot more heat to it. And, you know, fast forward, 10 years later, 1966 or so, Janis was with Big Brother and the Holding Company. Big Mama, lo and behold, was living in the Bay Area, performing at a little club. So Janis and her bandmates went down to see her perform, and she does this self-penned song, Ball and Chain. They were blown away. Janis started writing down the lyrics to the song on a piece of paper there, sitting in the club. They went backstage, got to meet Big Mama, and literally ask her permission for them to start covering that song. And she said, sure, as long as you don't mess it up, you know. And they did. Dave Getz, the drummer, used to say they Big Brotherized the song.
So I thought it would be interesting to hear the Big Mama Thornton recording and the Janis Joplin recording back to back, so we can hear something of, you know, what influenced Janis Joplin and how she made it her own. So here's Big Mama Thornton, followed by Janis Joplin, and both of these recordings were made in 1968.
Sitting by my window, Big Mama was sitting there looking at the rain.
So that was Big Mama Thornton, followed by Janis Joplin and Big Brother and the Holding Company, all of that recorded in 1968. And my guest is Holly George Warren, author of a new biography of Janis Joplin called Janis. We'll talk more after a break, and we'll hear from actress Katherine Hahn. She stars in the new HBO series, Mrs. Fletcher. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Holly George Warren, author of a new biography of Janis Joplin. George Warren writes about how Joplin grew up in segregated Texas, but was able to cross musical, cultural, and sexual boundaries and become an icon of the counterculture. She was there at pivotal moments in 60s rock history, the Monterey Pop Festival, the vibrant Haight-Ashbury scene in San Francisco, Woodstock. Joplin's brief life was ended by a heroin overdose in 1970 when she was 27. When we left off, we were talking about how early in her career, Joplin started building an audience in Texas clubs, singing folk music, bluegrass, and blues. Then she moved west. She goes to San Francisco and becomes part of Big Brother and the Holding Company, the band. How do they all get together?
Well, interestingly, Terry, a lot of people don't realize that the time she joined Big Brother and the Holding Company was in June 1966. That was actually the third time she had been out there to San Francisco. So in January 1963, the week that Janis turned 20 years old, she hitchhiked to San Francisco and started a career, so-called career, I mean, sleeping in basements and living off $5 a day or whatever, singing Bessie Smith songs and some originals that she had started writing in folk clubs in the Bay Area in North Beach. She first met Jorma Kaukonen, Jerry Garcia. They were doing the same kind of thing at little open mic nights and tiny little folk clubs. So she did that for about 3 years. Things started to take a bad turn as far as some self-destructive habits that she picked up while there. So she ended back in Texas for a year in 1965. started singing again on the circuit in Houston with Guy Clark, Townes Van Zandt. And then Chet Helms, who had stayed in San Francisco, was managing this band of musicians called Big Brother and the Holding Company. They called their music freak rock because it was lots of feedback and super loud electric guitars, etc. And they decided they wanted a female singer in the band. Now, Janis had never, ever performed with electric instruments before. She went to San Francisco to give it a try, and just it completely changed her head around performing and singing with these roaring electric guitars, bass, and drums, and just the whole ballroom vibe of that was going on in San Francisco in the summer of 66 at places like the Avalon Ballroom, the Fillmore, which was so different from anything she had ever done before musically.
A really difficult decision for her is what, after the Monterey Pop Festival, when she was on screen and people could really see she is a star. Everyone in the music industry who she worked with was trying to talk her out of leaving Big Brother and the Holding Company and just going solo. And Big Brother and the Holding Company had just, they'd all just moved in together. They were happy with the arrangement they had. And she seemed to like know that the band wasn't up to her standards musically, but she didn't want to leave them. Can you talk about how painful it was for her to figure out what to do?
Janis had two sides. One was she loved having that community, that family of Big Brother and the Holding Company, who really gave her the underpinnings to work out her musicianship, to climb the ladder. You know, she was very ambitious from the beginning. Big Brother was kind of this cool, you know, freaky, you know, hanging out, improvisational band. But they were not, it was all about feel with them. They were not these precise musicians that tried to play every part perfectly every time. Janis, on the other hand, she had that perfectionist mindset when it came to her music. She wanted to be the best singer. She wanted to be perfect. She was the first one in the recording studio and the last one to leave. She worked really hard to be as good as she possibly could. And she was also a restless soul when it came to her music. She didn't want to stay with just one style, one sound of music. And also, belting the way she was, the banshee wail that she developed with Big Brother and the Holding Company, that really was not sustainable. That was going to wreck her voice. So she wanted to sing with more nuance. And she liked jazz. She liked Broadway show tunes. You know, she wanted to try lots of soul music, R&B. There were a lot of things that she wanted to do that she was worried that Big Brother and the Holding Company either couldn't or wouldn't want to do. So it became just a matter of time before she finally did leave the band.
So she gets a new band, the Cosmic Blues Band. And so during this period when she's recording with the Cosmic Blues Band and she's separated from the band that she knew so well, that she was so close to, Big Brother and the Holding Company, what's happening in her personal life?
When she was out on the road, constantly backed up by what became known as the Cosmic Blues Band, Janis started turning to heroin as a way to just kind of numb herself from all the pressures and the fear of what it was like being a solo artist at that point in time in her career. Again, she was still very much a focal point of media. There was articles about her all the time, and she had developed this whole, you know, hard-drinking blues mama image that she had. So this was a secret vice of hers that she picked up. Unfortunately, it was, the heroin was pretty prevalent. No one really realized it at the time. And so she gradually got addicted to heroin in 1969.
And did she kick heroin before going back to it?
She tried to kick heroin a few times. She finally did almost for good in 1970, right about the time she had put together a new band, which became called Full Tilt Boogie Band. And she got off heroin for a while, actually, by going to Brazil for Carnival. And, I mean, it's so hard to believe that. I mean, she was a massive rock star. She was hitchhiking around in Brazil for a while, totally cleaned up, really loved the feeling of being clean and back to her old self again. Sadly, she relapsed when she got back to California. And then finally, she quit in the spring of 1970. And she stayed off of it for about 4 or 5 months until, tragically, she relapsed again while recording Pearl in Los Angeles. Got a very strong dose, very pure, kind of like what's happened horribly in recent times with fentanyl and things like that. It was much more pure than she had ever used before. And her tolerance was down. She was by herself, overdosed, and died October 4th, 1970.
How does Janis Joplin's music sound different to you now?
What's really struck me as I dove into Janis's music was all the different styles and different sounds that she could make with her voice. I guess I just thought she just kind of started singing and she was this full-blown singer and it just came out that way. But what I've realized from working on the book and doing all the research and listening to tons of music is how she worked with her voice, how she would purposefully evolve and change her style, and how she could sound so different depending on what the songs were, what the genre was, and, you know, also just technically what she could do. Just, you know, things like being able to hit like 3 notes at once, you know, just her technical prowess I've learned about. And it wasn't just a natural talent that she had. She worked really hard to become that good of a singer.
But, you know, it sounds like if journalists asked her about it, it was like, well, it's all about feeling. And it was way more than that for her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She really tried to hide that side of her. She didn't want people to know how hard she worked. Just like she tried to hide the fact that she was a total bookworm and read books all the time. I mean, when I read the letters that she wrote to her parents, that's when I learned so much about the real Janis that we didn't know about from just her persona and the image that she created. She would write her parents with these descriptions of what it's like, you know, overdubbing or double tracking her vocals or what the mixing process was like. I mean, she was getting all technical on all that kind of stuff. She was fascinated by the recording process. She loved it. And then again, I realized that she was a real scholar of music. She worked hard to find records, to analyze the records. And that was a big surprise for me to learn how much work she put into it and how long she spent working on this to become the singer that she was.
Holly George Warren, thank you so much for talking with us.
Wow, this has been so much fun. Thank you, Terry.
Holly George Warren's new biography of Janis Joplin is called Janis, Her Life and Music. In the psychological thriller The Lighthouse, Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson play two 19th century seamen stationed at a lighthouse off the coast of Maine. It's the second feature written and directed by the 36-year-old Robert Eggers, who made his filmmaking debut with the supernatural horror drama The Witch. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
The premise of The Lighthouse seems to have been cooked up during a long night of drunken revelry, and I mean that in the best possible way. It's as though someone dared the writer-director Robert Eggers to travel to the frigid north, construct a perfect replica of a 19th-century New England lighthouse, and film Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe slowly going insane for 2 hours. This is a brash and swaggering entertainment, a blisteringly funny horror movie soaked in rain, rum, and testosterone. It's also an exquisite piece of old-fashioned film craft, gorgeously shot in black and white in a nearly square aspect ratio that evokes the look of Hollywood's golden age. Even after 2 viewings, I'm still not entirely sure what, if anything, the whole experience adds up to, but I can't say I ever wanted to tear my eyes from the screen. The Lighthouse hooks you from its opening shot of a boat cutting across icy waters, bound for a lighthouse station on a rocky island off the coast of Maine. The movie was actually filmed at Cape Fortune in Nova Scotia. It's the 1890s, and for the next 4 weeks, this lonely outpost will be home for a veteran lighthouse keeper, Thomas Wake, played by Dafoe, and his young apprentice, a former lumberjack named Ephraim Winslow, played by Pattinson. Eggers shoots the two actors in stunning, screen-filling close-ups, letting us study the sculpted lines of Pattinson's face and count every hair in Defoe's mangy beard. Defoe, in particular, seems to be having the time of his life as Thomas, a crusty old sea dog with wild eyes, a foul temper, and horrible flatulence, the sound of which is nearly as distracting as the loud foghorn blasts we keep hearing in the distance. Thomas can have his odd moments of tenderness, especially when he has booze in his belly and a tall tale on his tongue, but he is mostly overbearing and cruel. He bars Ephraim from going anywhere near the lighthouse beacon, saddling him instead with menial tasks like keeping the furnaces burning and emptying the chamber pots. The tension comes to a head in one scene in which Ephraim, played by Pattinson, is being harangued about his duties by Thomas, played by Defoe.
What do you call that?
Sir?
What?
I mopped and swept twice over,
ye lion dog.
Well, I swept them.
Tis begrimed and bedabbled. Unwiped, unwashed, and disdained.
Get some kind of pert out of molesting me.
Come now.
I already says...
How dare ye contradict me, ye dog?
Now look here. I ain't never intended to be no housewife nor slave in taking this job. And it ain't right. These lodgings is more ramshackle than any shanty boys camp I ever seen. The Queen of England's old fancy housekeeper couldn't even done no better than what I done. Because I tell you, I scrubbed this here place twice over.
And I say you did nothing of the sort. And I say you swab it again and you swab it proper like this time. And you'll be swabbing it 10 times more after that.
Robert Eggers, who wrote the script with his brother Max Eggers, drew on the writings of 19th century authors like Herman Melville and Sarah Orne Jewett for inspiration, as you can tell from the antiquated formality of the dialogue. Eggers was a production and costume designer before he became a filmmaker, and he brings to each movie an obsessive attention to period detail. The Witch, his 2015 drama about a Puritan family exiled from their community, was similarly meticulous in its research of 17th century New England language and architecture. Even more than The Witch, The Lighthouse is a claustrophobic study of souls in isolation. Like The Shining and other cabin fever classics, it's a movie full of bad weather, guilty secrets, and violent hallucinations. There are visions of octopuses and mermaids writhing in the surf that recall the grotesque horror imagery of H.P. Lovecraft. Thomas and Ephraim's relationship is full of tempestuous ups and downs. One minute they're drunk, singing and carousing, the next minute they're at each other's throats. There's a homoerotic dimension to their close quarters intimacy. At times you're not sure if they're going to destroy each other or fall into a sweaty embrace. As formidable an acting partner as Defoe is, Pattinson more than holds his own in this ferocious battle of wills. He holds us at every step of Ephraim's psychological breakdown, showing us his growing dislike for Thomas and his determination to bury some ugly truths from his recent past. Meanwhile, the forbidden lighthouse tower glares down at him from above, taunting him like an Olympian flame, forever out of reach. In these moments, the lighthouse becomes a scathing takedown of the bitterly thwarted male ego, a story of two men drowning together in their lusts, regrets, and failures. It's an astonishing spectacle, if also at times a maddeningly indulgent one. Toward the end, Eggers seems reluctant to let his characters go, even after their conflict seems to have exhausted its dramatic potential. He seems even more reluctant to abandon the magnificent prison he's built for them. The lighthouse may be a little too in love with its own virtuosity, but you can hardly blame it. At a time when our movies are overrun with stale, derivative visions, its unrepentant madness feels like both a balm and a beacon.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. He reviewed the new movie, The Lighthouse. Coming up, we hear from actress Catherine Hahn, who stars in the new HBO series Mrs. Fletcher, about a divorced mother who has a confusing sexual reawakening after her son leaves home for college. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Catherine Hahn, stars in the new HBO series Mrs. Fletcher, which is adapted from the best-selling novel by Tom Perata, who created the series. Hahn is known for her roles in the TV series Transparent as Rabbi Raquel, and in Parks and Recreation as Jennifer Barkley, an aggressive political operative. Hahn starred in the films Bad Moms and Private Life. In Mrs. Fletcher, Hahn plays Eve Fletcher, a divorced mother of a teenage son. In the first episode, she drives him to college and becomes an empty nester. Just before the trip, after gassing up the car, she goes to his bedroom, where he's been sleeping off a hangover, and is shocked to hear from behind the closed door that he's having sex with a girl and he's giving her crude, derogatory sexual commands and calling her the B-word and a slut. On the drive to college, she tries to talk with him about how not to treat women.
I guess what I'm trying to say is I think there are things that you might say to a girl that could scare her without you even realizing it. I mean, look, I know you're not a virgin, right? You know, and I know there's porn and movies and, you know, all these songs about hoes and bitches and, that's what it is. So I guess that what I'm trying to say is I think one of the most important things for you to always remember, especially now, in this day and age, I mean, in life, really, is that you have to be nice to women. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
After dropping off her son, Eve returns alone to a big empty house. Kind of by accident, she finds porn on the internet, including lesbian porn, and is surprised by how arousing it is. The series alternates between her story and her son's story. He's unprepared for social life in college, where women students he's meeting demand respect and are serious about consent and no meaning no. Catherine Hahn, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you spend a lot of time thinking about how a woman like Eve could end up having a teenage son who's such a bro, beer-drinking, ogling girls kind of guy, treating them as sex objects? You know, did you try to think, like, how does that happen when the mother is, like, nothing like that?
Yes, I mean, I think it's despite her best, deepest intentions. I mean, there's not to put it all in this divorce that she went through, but he didn't have the greatest examples, male examples. And I think that in a time in which he could have had a lot more attention in terms of like his sexual development, he went right to the internet. And I think she kind of lost him or lost that connection along the way, despite her best intention. I think the harder she went towards him, the more it pushed him away. And that was heartbreaking to me. I think a lot of people can find that, unfortunately, really relatable. I mean, she really, it's like her worst nightmare. Of course, she doesn't think he's a horrible person, but she can also kind of see it. It's just like layers of denial.
So Eve Fletcher, your character, is having a very exciting solo sex life. Mm-hmm. Her and the internet.
Finally.
And she isn't really sure if and how she should extend that solo sexual life with internet porn into the real world. And if she does, because she's finding this porn, and especially this lesbian porn, very arousing.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you prepare for that part of the role? Did you feel like, well, it was your responsibility to watch a lot of porn to get into character?
I didn't feel like I had to watch a lot of porn. The porn for her was almost kind of like this Gandalf for her kind of discovery. It's the most private taboo thing, the most reckless kind of leap that she could possibly take, and also the most deeply, deeply private. And the avenues that she was able to see in that, the glow of that computer screen. So it wasn't about anything salacious or to show anything for anyone else's pleasure. It was for her own. And so that was a beautiful thing and a challenge to try to find, is this woman in her completely private bubble And we were surrounded by an incredible group of women directors and writers, and we had this amazing intimacy coordinator. That was what made it attractive to me. It was finding a woman in her complete privacy.
What does an intimacy coordinator do on set?
Well, that's interesting, Terry, because I'd never worked with one before. And I was a little hesitant at first, to be frank, because I thought it was going to be a voice in the way in between the director and the actor, like another voice. And it was not that at all. Our intimacy coordinator, Claire Warden, what she did was she would take all of us, anyone that was performing in the scene, and the director. She would have conversations with us on the eve of, no pun intended, but on the eve of whatever the scene was, and would make sure that we were aware of the what was on the page. This is above and beyond like the nudity riders or whatever that that would have already been signed. But she would take us all and make sure that we were aware of what was on the page to be filmed, make sure that we were all okay with that, walk us through the steps, make sure that our boundaries, our personal boundaries were in place for what we were comfortable with. And then she would be able to, so that when we walked in together, that we all knew that each other's needs and requests and concerns were heard. And then you could just get to the business of the scene so much quicker.
Is the crew in on this discussion too, or just the actors?
They're not in on those discussions, but what she will do is she will just make sure that the monitors are closed, that it's the fewest amount of people in the room, or she will ask us who we want in the room and make sure that it's just that amount of people, depending on what the scene is.
So, I don't know, it seems to me, and I don't know if you would agree with this, that you're kind of part of the first generation of women who came of age with women screenwriters and directors, and I mean more than one or two, that you had a cohort, and you've worked with some of them. I mean, you've worked with Nicole Holofcener, Tamara Jenkins, to name a few. And I'm wondering if you agree with that you're part of the generation, one of the first, or maybe the first, that had a cohort of women writers and directors.
Oh, God, I mean, that sounds terribly thrilling. I think I do feel like the most satisfying work I've done has been with women, for sure. That the most complicated and messy roles I've been able to get have been offered through women. And it's not lost on me that it's like the most fertile chapter of my life has been with these women. And it also is terribly exciting to me that it's older women, you know what I mean? That it's not just women that are, you know, when I was a young actor, I thought that having kids would be, I was terrified to have kids. And
you thought it would end your career?
Or, yeah, yes, or change it, or I'd be stopped being seen, or whatever. I'm just so buoyed and galvanized that the juiciest part of it has been post-kids. And not that that is even a choice for everybody. No one even has to have children, but I think it's more of an age thing that it's the most satisfying. It's like post-40. It's just, I never anticipated that. So that's terribly exciting.
So since you played a rabbi in Transparent, which is the series about a family in which one of the parents is a trans woman who has recently transitioned, and the children and the ex-spouse are all trying to figure out how to recalculate like who this person is and what their relationship is with them is. And of course, each person in the family is dealing with a lot of their own problems, anxieties, stresses, insecurities, sexual issues. You play a rabbi that comes into the family's life. Now, you actually went to Catholic school.
Yes.
Your husband is Jewish. Mm-hmm. So how much did you have to learn? How much did you feel like you needed to know about Judaism in order to play the role of a rabbi?
You know, it's interesting. I spent a lot of time with the Rabbi Susan Goldberg. She was an enormous touchstone for me throughout all of it, just as a person and as a guide. And I knew that I couldn't intellectually learn everything that there was to know, but I knew just heart-wise and spiritually, like, I think that we were able to have established such a connection when I spent time with her. I think there was such a, she has such beautiful eye contact, arresting eye contact, in which you just feel so held and so seen. And so that was, I think, my way into Raquel, and just stillness, which I don't have myself.
No, your character doesn't have stillness. I wouldn't say your character had stillness.
She has much more stillness than I do, Terry. No, yeah, but Raquel certainly doesn't. It's a little of a restless wanderer, for sure. But I did find, I think, just spending time with Susan was my way in, for sure. What was so interesting or radical about it, and I think why I also love the hot priest in Fleabag so much, which I feel so bad he keeps being called the hot priest, but is that I think there is also, there's always something really interesting or kind of radical about seeing a person, a holy person or a religious person, just like brought down to earth, or seeing them in all of their humanity, and with all their foibles, and I think that was so, that was what was so interesting about Raquel to me, and so that she was so crazily relatable. Rabbi Goldberg had talked with me about how people have a hard time relating to you as a religious person or a religious figure because you're so somewhat so untouchable, and yeah, you're just a person who gets mad at people and gets pissed at people and, you know, gets jealous, has all the feelings. So that was a really interesting, really fun part to play, really hard part to play. And boy, did I love playing with Jay Duplass. He's just so terrific.
And he plays the sibling.
Yes,
who you have
Josh.
A relationship with. You went to Yale School of Drama in your late 20s. And I may be wrong, but I think that most people who go to Yale School of Drama do it.
No, you're right. Most people
right
go when they're like,
ingenue.
Right, exactly. No, I knew going in, like, I remember somebody saying, like, you're missing out on all your ingenue years, like somebody told me. And I was like, I'm not an ingenue anyway, so it doesn't matter. Like, and I just knew that I wanted to go. I just was like, I had been working at a hair salon, which was a ball, but clearly not what I wanted to do. And I was doing summers at Williamstown, which I loved. But I just was tired of struggling. Like, I just was, it was a constant, you know, it was those years in New York where you're like, I would just walk to get the backstage, you know, whenever it came out on Wednesdays or something, like, be circling you'd get the backstage paper for the auditions, and I would be like circling them, and I didn't have an agent. And nothing was happening. It was like a lot of like no pay jobs. Like, it was like, and I was just tired of struggling. But again, I just knew that there was nothing else. I just had no doubt in my mind. I wouldn't even explore another question of a job. Like, there was no other job. So I just was like, okay, I'll just take out a ton of debt, and I'll try to get into a grad school somewhere, and at least I'll have like 3 years until the character roles start coming in. I'll just have like 3 years of at least being able to just take a breath and just work. And
did it work out how you wanted it to?
Well, I just remember I did a play there, this John Robbie Bates play. I wish I could remember the name of it. But anyway, he talks about having a rigorous and monastic experience, and I just feel like that's what it was for me, Yale. Like, where it was just, I didn't have a television. I lived in one room. Ethan stayed back in New York and kept our apartment, and I would take the train back on the weekends. And just hear, like, next stop, you know, Stanford, Connecticut. I loved how they said Connecticut. It was the best. We would be rehearsing at 2 in the morning, and I would get up and get my muffin and my iced coffee and watch my beautiful classmates perform scenes. And for roles we'd probably never get in the real life, but it was just like a chance to, like, I just knew that was the only time in my life I would have a chance to really, really just do that.
So then you had to go on auditions. What were some of your worst?
I had so many. But I mean, I also remember even in my last, you know, semester at Yale, we would go literally from, I would take the train in to 30 Rock. There was a Banana Republic at the base of 30 Rock. I would go into the Banana Republic. I would buy a suit, go up, audition for a pilot, go down, return the suit at Banana Republic, and then get on the train and go back, promptly get on the, and never get the gigs. But
why did you need a suit?
You know, because it was like all those pilots where you had to like look polished, and I just didn't have any of it. You know, I had nothing. I just remember my agents running, like yelling after me down the hallway, run a brush through your hair before I would go on any audition, because I would just not, just like deodorant everywhere. There were so many. I just remember I had a really bad Woody Allen audition that was just awful.
What was
horrible
it like?
For a play. It was for a play, and I remember someone telling me that he wasn't going to look up and laugh, that he just wouldn't laugh at all, that he was just going to stare down. And I just remember stare down at his. This was years and years and years and years and years ago. But I just whatever. It was just like a long time ago. But I remember auditioning. And it was true. He did not laugh at all. And not only did he not laugh, but he looked up when I just botched a joke so badly. It was awful. It was just red face, awful. And I was like, well, there's that. There's that. And there's so many of them. The Coen brothers, that was a heartbreaker. Yeah, it's like the more I want something,
what happened with the Coen brothers?
You're like, stop it right there.
Yeah, stop it right there.
It was for a serious man, and
I love that
just...
film.
Oh, me too. It was amazing. And it's an incredible film. And I was way gung-ho. And again, should have learned from my stillness what I learned from stillness. And I did not. And I brought in a bag of props. And just it was too much. It was just way too much for the space. And they were very polite and very kind, and I did not get the part.
Catherine Hahn, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, a dream, really. Thank you so much.
Catherine Hahn stars in the new HBO series, Mrs. Fletcher. Fresh Air Weekend was produced this week by Heidi Simon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Teresa Madden, Mooj Zaidi, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.